Now tonight we're going to continue talking a little bit more about CGI programming, now that you've learned a little more Perl. So I hope that you were able to do the CGI example, the simple one that you were doing for tonight. And we'll talk about some more advanced topics tonight. So I want to start by sort of giving a short talk which does a little bit of background on the HTTP process and more about how the messages are passed between the browser and the server, just for, you know, good background and information about how this works so you understand what's going on. One of the reasons I think that it's important to understand what the process is about doing CGI is that I think that the CGI mechanism, while it's kind of the backbone of the whole web technology area in a lot of ways, is probably the most likely to change in details over time, so that you will have to go find out any time that you want to do CGI programming sort of what's the current state. After I do the background part, I will go to a further example of a CGI script, a more extended example, and then I'll finish up the CGI talk just giving a little bit about some of the advanced topics for more kinds of CGI scripting than you do with just the basic mechanism that we discussed so far. So again, just to talk a little bit about some of the acronyms that we're using, MIME stands for Multipart Internet Mail Extensions. It's the standard or the protocol for how messages are formatted as they are passed across the Internet. It extends the basic email formatting that has been in use for years. Then HTTP is the essentially the World Wide Web protocol, and it is very similar to the MIME protocol, but extends it in some important ways. And this is the standard protocol for how messages are sent from the client to the client, which has the web browser, to the web server and back again. So these both talk about formats of messages that are passed across the Internet for various purposes. Then URL stands for Uniform Resource Locator, and it is part of the HTTP protocol. It is the way, the standard addressing scheme for looking up files on web servers, and it's how you address anything in the world that's on the World Wide Web. And finally, CGI, which we talked about last time, you may recall, stands for Common Gateway Interface, and it's the way in which you extend the whole basic scheme of requesting documents from the web server to be able to request any kinds of computation or access to other software on the web server. So CGI, the script language, the scripting, the scripts that you can write in various languages, and we wrote ours in Perl, give access from the web server to all the other computational resources that you might be making available to people on the web. Yes?
What's the reason people really use Perl and C for CGI but then not have it in?
Well, people that use C, I think it's just because that is kind of a standard Unix language that people are used to working in. Perl has that same kind of property. People are probably not quite so used to working in Perl, but Perl is particularly well-suited because it makes it so easy to do things with strings, and it's very powerful. You talked about the regular expressions and the string matching last time. It's very powerful in how it can work with strings, and it's also pretty easy to be able to access sort of the rest of the system resources. I don't think you've seen quite as much detail about that yet, but it is pretty easy for Perl to not only access the file system, which C can do as well, but to issue sort of arbitrary Unix commands and change directories and work with file protections and all sorts of things that are very sort of low-level system-oriented. And I think that's really why people pick Perl a lot. But it is possible to do CGI scripting in a lot of different languages, Basic, Visual Basic. You need, essentially, input and output to standard in and standard out, and you need to be able to get access to environment variables. There has to be a way built for you to programmatically do that. Now, what does it mean to be a standard or a protocol for things dealing with the Internet and the World Wide Web? And basically, there is no one company or authority which governs how things work on the Internet in general, and in particular on the World Wide Web, which is built on top of that. The way that the Internet works, standards for email messages, have been built up over time by the community of people that use them. And this has become standardized in a process that's run by an organization called the Internet Engineering Task Force. And there are, this is not just one particular company, this is a group of people who are all interested in that. You can get interested and involved in these evolving protocols as well. So any time that something new is proposed, like when the MIME messages were proposed as an extension of standard email, what happens is that the people who are working in this area usually write some sort of prototype. There may be several people who write prototypes of this kind of thing. They're interested in solving particular problems, and they all write up drafts, that is, working documents that describe how they would like to solve this problem and what are the special formatting and protocols that they would like to use. So the Internet Engineering Task Force, the IETF, registers all these draft proposals, gives them numbers, puts them up, makes them available on the web now for everybody to read and to work with. Out of these various drafts, usually, or there are usually several to solve a particular problem. For example, right now, there are various drafts coming along about doing real-time streaming video and audio, making a general process of that. Anyway, as these people work together, they try to distill this down to one document that really everyone can agree to. And then this is usually put up as an Internet memo, and these are always referred to as usually by RFC numbers, which are requests for comments. So again, they're posted, and people, these are more formal documents and are meant to be candidates for a standard that that a lot of the people have already agreed on. So after the memo has been commented on and people have had a chance to discuss it, it may be just adopted as a standard as it stands. There may be revisions made, but if it's successful, then it will get adopted as a standard, and the IETF may also assign it a standard number that has the prefix STD. So for example, there's an old document which does original Internet email, and this should be RFC. I'm sorry about that. There's a typo. 822 or as standard 11. So these are numbers assigned to them. So if you're interested in a particular topic, you want to know what's happening with real-time streaming servers, you can go look on the Internet and see what some of the proposals are and see what people are doing about it. Here's a list of some of the Internet documents that are relevant for this background section. The first one is the standard Internet email messages. It's old. It's 1982. Then there's also one about Usenet messages. There are two here about MIME extensions for messages. And then there's the one at the bottom, the Tim Berners-Lee draft, about HTTP protocols. So you can find all these on the web. You can look them up. And if you are particularly interested in things that are being worked on right now, there's a complete list under the IETF webpage. I think it's www.ietf.org. And there's also lists of these things at the World Wide Web Consortium, the W3.org is their website. Well, both. I've heard both. So I think people refer to it in different ways in different places. That doesn't seem to have been part of the standard. It's exactly what the name means. So just for interest, let's look at a little bit at what some of these standards look like that we're dealing with when we do CGI programming or when we do requests between web clients and browsers. So to start with, it's all built on the old traditional email that goes across the internet. And so here's a specification of how email is supposed to look. Each message is a stream of 7-bit ASCII characters, and there is always a header part, and then a blank line, and then a body, or an optional body. The body may not be there. The header always consists of a set of entries which are a key value pair, and the key is followed by a colon. So the keys can't have any spaces or tabs and can't exceed 63 characters. And listed down here at the bottom is a should be familiar list of the kind of header keys that you normally see in email messages, right? Date from, to, copy, blind copy, forward copy, resent. You see these keywords in the headers of email messages. Now there was built in, so the body is unstructured sequence in the original email specification, but there was built in a mechanism for extending the types of header fields that you could have. Namely, in addition to the standard list, you could introduce your own header fields as long as they started with an X. So you could have your own headers when you send email, header fields, as long as the person that you're mailing it to had an emailer, email program that liked to recognize that header as well. So it didn't have to be recognized by everybody in the world. So that was the basic idea about email messages. Notice that email messages are fairly long, and actually, and you always have the notion that they are originate at one point and end up at one point. That's not actually how they're transmitted across the network. The network is based is packet-based. It's based on the protocol TCP/IP, and the message is actually broken up into individual packets, all of which, again, have an address. The various packets may be routed various ways, but they have, in addition to address information, sequence information, so that the person that receives those packets on the other end knows how to put them back together into the message that you expected to get there. So on top of that standard email thing was put this MIME extension, which was meant to enlarge the kinds of messages that you could send. In particular, people wanted to send things besides text. They wanted to send multimedia documents, and they wanted to be able to send formatted documents. They wanted to be able to send Word documents or whatever, as well as possibly audio files or something like that. So there was a working group formed by the IETF, and they put forward a draft, and very quickly people started picking up and implementing this in mailers. The actual MIME format retains essentially the standard form of the original email message. There is a header, and there's the optional body. There, it allows new header fields, and it allows for a whole new structure of what the body contents can be added to a particular header field called content type. So content type is one of the new header fields. There's a whole structure of content types that are introduced to say what things the body can be. One of the content types that's allowed is multi-part, which says that this message is going to be sent in various pieces. So you can send part of your message to start, and then after some time you may send more of the message if it's a multi-part message. So there was a scheme set up that was a two-level scheme for the types of messages. There are a set of base types, and then you put a slash, and then there's a set of subtypes for each base type. The base types, there are seven base media types defined. This minimal set is all there is. If you want to add a base type, you have to go through the whole standard protocol process with the IETF. But the subtypes are much less restrictive. People can add subtypes fairly freely, and already there's a large number of subtypes added. For text, we have plain text, rich text, there's text class HTML, as you know, that you've been working with, and many more are assigned. So there is part of the IETF is the numbers authority. You must register subtypes with them, but you can introduce private experimental subtypes prefixed with an X. On the next two slides are a little more detail about the base types. I'm not going to go through this too much, but notice that with the text, one of the things is rich text, which is another one of these markup languages similar to HTML. One of the base types for text is HTML. Another thing that you can do with text is add to the content type what the character set is. So there are various character sets, US, ASCII, French, Japanese, and so on. There is a little bit of trouble because you still have to use the 7-bit ASCII encoding scheme, it really would be nicer if some of these character sets could be a little bit bigger. One of the base types is image. There are various subtypes for sending images. Audio and video are standard subtypes, or standard base types, excuse me. Multipart is one of them. Messages for regular messages. And finally, applications for just sort of miscellaneous anything, things like PostScript, other kinds of formats that could be produced by an application program that aren't necessarily a standard media type. So here's a list of some of the implementations that are available. I think this list is a little bit outdated. I know that here a lot of people use Pine, and it does do a lot of the MIME types. So next we come to HTTP, the Hypertext Transport Protocol. So this is really built on top of, as you know, the World Wide Web is built on top of the whole Internet Protocol. And the idea of the MIME formatted messages was also used for the HTTP protocol. It's not quite the same, but it's fairly close, and it keeps this idea of the header, the formatted header, with the keyword value fields and the unformatted body that's so basic to all of this. Furthermore, the HTTP protocol is compatible with other Internet services. On the Internet, you can have services such as FTP, which is the file transfer protocol, That's for transferring files from one host to another host over the Internet. There's the network news transfer protocol for getting news groups. There's, of course, the email protocol. What else? Well, there are some others. I don't remember off the top of my head. So the HTTP protocol is compatible with these other kinds of network services. You can just list it as another network service. Furthermore, the HTTP service works very similar to all the other network services on Unix-based machines. Namely, there's the idea that on a Unix-based machine, there are a number of ports, which are unique places where a service is provided. So these ports are numbered from, the standard ones are numbered from 1 to 1024. There are ports above that, all the other four-digit numbers above that can be used for port numbers by application programs. The lower ones are assigned by the administrator of the operating system. So there are standard ports, like port 21 is FTP service, port 43 is Telnet service. Oh, that's one service I forgot to mention. And port 80 is assigned to the HTTP service. So what happens is that this is a host machine. It has an Internet connection, and a message will come in from the Internet. And it will be, they're all compatibly formatted so that the operating system can look at the format of the message and tell which service, well, there will be a, I'm sorry, let me back up a minute. Along with the messages, there will be an address of this host, and there will be a port number that it, the message is supposed to be addressed to, or there will be encoded the kind of service that's expected to get, and the operating system knows which port to send that to. So how do these programs handle the messages that arrive at the various ports? So these, the FTP service, the Telnet service, the HTTP service are programs that are servers, and they're sometimes called daemons because they're supposed to be started and then essentially run forever. And what these daemons or servers do is just sit there waiting for messages, and every time they get a message, it's a request, and they have to satisfy that request and send a reply if one is required. So the HTTP daemon here is, in fact, what we normally call the web server program. It's a program which you just start running, and it sits there and listens for HTTP requests. So when you're using the World Wide Web, you use, as part of the HTTP protocol, addresses of the forum that are known as URLs, the Uniform Resource Locator. And here we're going to show a bit more detail about the standard form of URL. You've all probably used these as addresses of documents on the web, but these are also compatible with the other service, Internet services. In fact, the first thing that you do is the name of the service. So normally when you're using a web browser retrieving a document, this thing is HTTP :// because it's the HTTP service. But you can also put FTP there or mail to for email or Telnet, or there's a standard set names of the other Internet services so that you can use the web browser to address messages to other services. In particular, you can retrieve files using FTP service just by putting a link to something that's an FTP server on another machine. Or you can put that mail to link, which is going to send email to another machine. So after the ./, you have the machine address, and this can either be the it's supposed to be the Internet address, and it can either be the one provided by the domain name service, which is the one you're used to, I think, with words like npac.syr.edu, or it's the actual IP numbers, which is something like 128.230. And I forget the rest of them, whatever they are. I think everything at SU is 128.230, right? And then after that, there's some other numbers, which I've forgotten. So all that part is sort of standard for all internet type messages. After that slash, though, for the HTTP service, what follows is a file, is a path to a file, and it will have a dot, and then it will have a file extension. So this file is specified by any Unix path name from the directory, which is known to the server as document root. When you install a web server, you have several configuration files you have choices about how it's installed. And one of the things you tell it is where all the HTML documents are going to be. That directory is known as document root. And you also tell it where all the CGI programs are going to be. That's the CGI bin. You can also set some other options. You don't need to have any other document directory besides that. But you can also set the option that it's allowed to have path names of the form tilde user ID. And you can also choose to have the directory public underbar HTML automatically included in the path name. So for example, if you have web pages on seer.edu, or what's that called? web.seer.edu, you just put in your home directory, you put a directory called public underbar HTML, and in there you put all your web documents, right? And you address it as tilde your user ID slash whatever web document it is. And that's because the server was installed that way. The Osprey 7 web server that you're using at MPAC for the CGI scripts is not installed that way. So you can't give path names in that form. Now in the HTTP service, the file extension on the file is used to tell the browser what type of file it is and what application it should use to view the file. So if it's AU, then it knows to run an audio player and so on. And so when you have a browser, you can configure it to tell it what helper applications you want to use for those various extensions. You can install new extensions. So here's a little more detail about how the browser web server connection works. So as you know, when you're working at the browser, you have a set of there's a set of hyperlinks, and you can click on one, or else you can give the URL directly in the location field. When you initiate that connection, the browser formats a MIME type message, and that sends it to the server. The server decides what to do and responds with another MIME-like message, which is received by the browser, and the browser either views that directly or runs a helper application to view that. And then the connection is closed on both sides. Actually, I haven't quite given all the detail here because actually before the request is sent from the browser to the server, the browser sends an open the connection message that we don't normally have to worry about at all. The server sends back a reply that says, yes, I'm here. Or if it's not here, you get that little box that says the server didn't respond. Then when the connection is set up, the browser actually sends the MIME request, and then the server sends back the response, and then the connection is closed. So I thought it would be interesting just to see what some of these MIME-type messages look like. So here's an example of what a browser might send to a web server as an HTTP request message that was initiated by a form that had method equal get. And the main difference between what HTTP does and the standard MIME format, it has this additional first line, which has this syntax for request messages, that there's the method followed by the URL protocol and followed by the URL, and then the protocol and version number of what kind of service you're expecting to do. So there's just an additional line that sort of sets up with the web server what protocol you're expecting. That's considered to be part of the header, and then in addition in the header there are several fields that are set up by the browser. This user agent field specifies the browser type, and then there are various fields which are have the keyword accept, and these are the types of all the files that this browser will accept. And normally it's quite a much bigger list than this, so that the web server is expected to send back a reply that's in one of these formats. There can be other fields depending on what the browser is trying to do. This is an example showing a from field, although typically browsers don't send the name of the user that's actually making the request. So this is a header. This is an example of a request message in which there is no body. There will just be a blank line terminating this request. So this is the way the message looks. This is, fortunately, when you're programming CGI, you never actually have to format these messages. The browser does it for you. You just click on the link, and the browser does the rest. Here's an example of what a formatted reply would look like from the server. Again, there's a special first line that specifies what the protocol version is. Then there are these various header fields. Now, when you're doing a CGI script, you are expected to supply at least one of these header fields. Namely, you're expected to supply either content type, in this case text/HTML, or location, or I forget what the error reports are called. Remember? No. Anyway, there's a third thing. So your CGI script is expected to put that in there. For the most part, the web server will then put the rest of the header on for you. So it puts on all this other stuff, the date, what's the kind of server. It's a server, a lot of the servers come from NCSA, or it could come from a company like Netscape or Microsoft. What version of MIME it's using, and so on. In this case, there is a body to the reply, so there will be a blank line separating the header and the body. The body is unformatted, but the web server will take care of counting how many characters there are and sending the link for you. Now, there are various applications, other types of CGI scripts, which I'll talk a little bit about at the end of the lecture, in which, in fact, your CGI script can supply other header fields. So it's okay for your script to supply lots of header fields, and we'll see some of the uses of that. So the other example I have here is another example, just for balance, of what a browser request looks like. Here's a browser request that is from a form that had method equal post. So it has post method in the first line. It has various accept fields. And in this case, when method is post, there is a body. It's not an empty body. And so the browser will put on content type, and it will figure out the content length. And then it will encode all the data that the user typed in on the form in the way that we talked about before and send it as the body of the message. So that's just some more detail about how the messages look that are sent between the browser and the web server. So the next thing I'm going to show you is another example of a CGI script. Mehmet, would you mind finding the other talk, the CGI talk, on the SGI? your class page has a link to this web page, and we looked at some of the examples last time. We looked at Hello World, and we looked at fill out forms, the simple pizza, that's the pizza one. There's an example here I'm not going to go over, which is the mail form. So if you want to see, one of the things you can do in a CGI script, we have to do this in order to see the code. So in this Perl script, there is a call to the mail program of the system. So this is what happens when people type in stuff into a form, and what you want to do is format an email message and send it off to somebody. So there's an example showing how to do that. What I'm going to show you tonight is using a Unix file to collect information that people type into forms and to later be able to allow them to either look at all the information or to search for various pieces of information. And the example that we have here is one written by Tom Scavo, in which you can register that you are going to be using a certain type of LaTeX system. And what the information is kept, there's a record for each person, essentially, or possibly more than one record, but in which it has the person's name and their email address and what kind of computer they use and what kind of LaTeX that they might like to have. So how do you use... So first we should look at the HTML. Or I guess we don't have to, right? It's a form, method is post, the action field gives the script that we're going to use. And here are the various input fields where people type in email, their name, their email, and there are some check boxes to put in the kind of platform that you're going to be using. So to see this, we have to type in some of this stuff. Oh, can you get back to the, is there an index? They're all listed here, right? Yes, okay. Yes, that's fine. Wrong mouse. Okay. Power Mac. Let's just pick some tech. I don't really care. And then you say you want to register that that's the kind of tech that you want. So the page comes back and tells me that I typed in the input, or here's the input that I typed in, and asks me to verify if this is correct before it actually submits it to the database. And if you submit that, then it will add your information to the database, and then later, if you look things up, you'll be in there. So let's see how those scripts work. So, here's the first Perl script for the first form where you typed in the data. So here's the main program in this Perl script, and it has a function called readData that's very similar to the one we've been using all along. Then it checks to see if the data is valid, and if it is, it does this subroutine called confirm registration. Otherwise, it prints out errors. So here's the read data routine, and it uses the same, first thing it does is call read parse, which is the standard function read parse that you worked with in your last assignment. So you know that when you get done with read parse, what you have is an associative array called in that has, with every field name from the input form, a value associated with it. So in typical fashion, we go through and we introduce variables for all of the fields. People typed in their name, their email, what machine they had, what platform they had, and what kind of tech application. Or they could choose to have an other field. So now let's skip down past the read parse function, because we talked about that last time. Whoops, I went too far. Okay. So the first subroutine that was called was this subroutine called valid data. It was a Perl routine that's supposed to return a Boolean result. And in Perl, that's either a 0 or a 1. Well, or a 0 or a non-zero, actually, like it is in C. We have a local variable called isOK. It's a scalar variable that's going to hold this result. So we start out with isOK 1, meaning true. And we start out another variable, a string variable, called $messages, which is the empty string. And all this does is it goes through and tests the various fields to make sure that you type something in. It's not going to allow you to have blank fields. So if name is blank, then on messages we append or we concatenate a message error name omitted, and we set is okay to be false. So if email is blank, we append that error message, and if people check the other application but then they didn't type in another field, again, you get an error because of having blank input. So if you look at the main program, if is okay is false, then we would have gone to this other subroutine that was going to print errors. But if is okay is still true, name, which is what happened with me because I typed in all the information, then it calls this subroutine confirm registration. And that's what I want to look at because it's the one that is going to go to the page which allows you to add things to the database. So this puts up a new HTML page in which it prints the information and asks you to confirm that it's all okay. So it prints confirmation requests and it puts the name, the email, the platform, the tech application, and asks if that's okay. Now notice that in addition to printing out the information for the user to verify that it's okay, it has more information. Namely, it has a form that consists that has a bunch of hidden input fields. And the hidden input fields are all the information that the user typed in. And finally, there's a button, a submit button, that said install. So if the information was okay, then the user clicked install, and all these fields will be submitted as if they were on an input form. Okay? Otherwise, the information wouldn't come back to the next script. So this is a way of passing information from one CGI script to another. The two CGI scripts are called independently, and so they can't pass information to each other. But you can do it by virtue of these hidden fields. So if we go back to this form, not sure how to get back the frame source. No, this is not what I wanted. Okay, I'm not getting one. But if you looked at the HTML for this page, you would see that regular HTML, it printed out these values. And then at the bottom here is a form in which all the input fields are hidden, and all there is this submit button. So when we submit, we pass this to the next form, and again, it will have all those that input that it can read. So let's look at this form. And this is the form that actually then is going to append the data to the database. Now, for a database, unlike what you've been starting with Oracle, we're just going to use a Unix file. So each time that somebody makes an entry, we're going to enter a record into the file. So one way to keep records in this flat file is to introduce a syntax that allows multi-line records, and that's what this program does. What I'm going to ask you to do for your homework next week is to write a similar thing, but to format it so that each record of information that you collect is just a single line in the file. It ought to be slightly easier, make for a slightly simpler program. So here's an example of how the file is formatted, and in fact, on the things I handed out to you, I think at the very last page, has an example printout of the database file at a particular time. So each record has this tag on it. The fields are named with a name followed by a colon, and then the value of the field, and then it's followed by a semicolon. Then the next field has its name, colon, its value, followed by a semicolon, and actually you can have any number of fields in here with any number of lines. So this is a nice format to use when you have lots of fields and you don't want them to run over. So the button that actually where you submitted this form was the install field. So first we're going to read the data. If we're supposed to install it, if it says yes, then we will go to this subroutine called process data. So the read data routine is similar to the ones we've seen already. So let me skip over that pretty quickly. It calls read parse, and it reads all the information off of the form that had all those hidden fields. So here's the process data, and the first thing that process data subroutine does is call a subroutine called update database file, or update DB file. So let's look at that first. So here's that subroutine, and so what this is going to do is take those fields and append a record to the existing file. So it uses the Perl open command to open the file. It happens to be called register.db, and it's going to open this file for appending, so you put two greater than signs in front of it. And you assign it a name, in this case it's called DB file. This is a little bit non-standard, because normally you make that be all caps but for file handles, but Perl doesn't actually require that. This is a slightly different version of the program that I made some modifications here. If you're actually running this on the web, you can have a bunch of people trying to add things to the database file at one time. And Unix is not careful at all about making sure that only one person accesses the file at a time. In fact, even if you're not reading or writing the same line of the file, it can mess things up. So I added, for practical use, after you open the file, you want to add a lock so that only one person at a time is actually either reading or writing the file at the same time. So on your copy of this program, I believe the next statement is flock with the name of the file handle and a value of 2, which means that is a Unix, it's like the Unix flock mechanism. It will If the file is already in use, it won't proceed with the program until it can lock the file and gain exclusive use to it. So you lock the file by calling flock with the file handle in 2, and you unlock it, you release the lock by calling flock with the file handle in 8. And that's what we do at the end here. So you open for appending, you lock the file, then we're going to append the information just by printing another line onto the file. So we're printing these things in our format. We want the first line to have this record tag. So to go to a new line, we put this slash n. Then we put the name field and its value, the email field and its value. We go to a new line. We put platform, and then we either put TEP application or we put the other one. And finally, we print the line that has the slash record to close that particular record. We issue the flock that unlocks the file, and then we close it. So that's the code that appends the data that you got to the file. So if we go back up to this process data subroutine, after it updates the database file, it just printed back this page to the user saying, thank you, we got your request, we added you to the file, everything is cool. But if it turned out that we weren't supposed to submit the stuff, then we have a routine down here that just reloads the original form. Yes? Well, the file could get garbled data. It could get mixed up. Even if only one person is writing and the other people are reading, it's possible. They say not to count on Unix not getting that messed up. No, it's just that the file won't have correct data in it. It might get messed up. Okay? Now you don't have to worry about that with Oracle, because that's what database products do for you, is worry about that kind of stuff for you. So they will try to lock, and then it will just wait until it can get access. What? No, that's if you can't open it, then you give the message. If it's just that the lock can't proceed, then you just wait until the other user is done, until you can proceed with the lock. Now notice that all the programs which are accessing this file are supposed to be written by you, so that you undertake to be nice and always lock the file and unlock it when you're done with it. It requires that cooperation for this whole scheme to work. Yes, it will wait until it can get the access. Right, then that will be a problem because you're not cooperating and nobody else will be able to... What? Oh, actually, I'm not sure what happens. Maybe when you close the file, it will unlock it for you. I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not sure about that. Another interesting thing to try. Okay, so that's appending something to the database. Now we come to the other part, which is once that people have added lots of data, we want to give them a way to look at the data. So this particular example allows you to look at the data in one of two ways. You can either click this button called Browse the Database, which will go read all the records from the file and produce an HTML page which has them all, or you can choose to search the database, which is you can put in a search string and it will go find all the records which have that string in it. And the latter thing is the kind of thing I'm asking you to do in your homework, but I'm asking you to do a more complicated search because we wanted to have a homework in which you did some string matching and used some of the regular expression constructs that you've been learning about in Perl. So what I'm going to show you now is the browse the database part. So when you say browse the database, it goes to the database, it reads each record, and it prints it out here. Notice it has a mail link to the email addresses formatted on the HTML page, but other than that, it's just the information in each record. So a bunch of us have been trying this out. If you try this out, then you'll show up on this list too. Oh, a lot of people have been, okay. And this is the one I just typed in. When I was doing that, when I was demonstrating the program before, and I tried it out in my office before I came down here. So I have two that are just alike. So every time I give this, I show this example, I add another record to the database. So let's look at the Perl code that does this, that goes to the file, reads all those records, and prints them out like that. So here is the Perl code. Oh, let me make it bigger for you. Put a bigger window. And it's going to it has a read data routine that all it does is it's going to see if your request was to do a browse or to do a search. And if you did a search, what is the search string? So the only real field is the search string. So then we go to process data to see what to do. So first of all, the Perl program process data looks at the variable, the associative array in, to see which of those two form buttons was pushed. This is the same CGI script for two different forms. And if the first button was pushed, the first form, then there will be a field defined called browse. But if the second one was pushed, then there will be a field defined called search. And in that case, there will be a search string, or there should be a search string. And if there isn't, we give people some other page. So let's look at browse database. So browse database is going to send back a reply which has all this HTML header, and then it's going to list all the records from the database. So that's the part we want to look at. And here's the part that reads the database and writes the output. So we open the file register.db for reading. If you open for reading, you don't have to put the less than sign there, although you can. Now, again, you want to do an flock here, and I believe in my copy of the program I have that, so that if somebody else is writing at the same time, you don't get corrupted data. Now, there's a while loop here which reads one line from the file at a time. And this is going to be more complicated than your case. I'm asking you to do this where each line is considered to be a record. In this case, each line is only part of a record, so this program has a little more complicated structure. First of all, we take off the new line. Now, the record starts with the tag less than record, greater than, and it ends with the tag slash record. So first of all, we check for those two cases. If the line starts with the record tag, then we have some code for pre-processing, whatever we want to do to start this off. In this particular case, there was nothing required. Otherwise, if the line is the slash record, we want to finalize, do whatever we're going to do with the record. In our case, we want to print it out to the HTML page. But meanwhile, let's look at the part down here, the else part. This is the part that the line you've read is in this variable called $record. And so these are all the lines that are in the middle that have fields. So $record has one or more fields of this record in it. So here's an example of a regular expression to match what is in the line dollar sign record. So we'd use the string match operator. We just use regular the slash, which is supposed to match the first substring that we come to that fits this criteria. And the first thing we have in parentheses is backslash W. Now, I can never remember all of these fancy, you know, special characters, but I go to my little Perl book and I look them up, and it will say backslash W is any word character, upper and lower case, alphabetic and underscore are the word characters, I believe. So slash W matches one such character. Star says match any number of those. So this slash W star will match any number of word characters. Furthermore, it puts it in, by putting it in parentheses, later we can recall what the string that matched that. Do you remember that part? That's the memory part of the regular expression. Okay, so we're going to match any number of word characters followed by a colon. So what's going to match here is the, it'll take as many word characters as it can, and this will match the name of the field. Then there will be a colon, and now, in parentheses, we're going to match something else. Square brackets denotes a, It's a sequence of characters, right? Or a set of characters. I forget what it's called. A set? Okay, so this is a set of characters. What characters are supposed to be in here? Well, this hat character means not. So the characters that are in this set is everything except for semicolon. And then we put a star on that, so we'll match any number of characters that are anything except for semicolon. Right? And so we put that in parentheses so we can remember it later. Then we match the semicolon, and then we're done. So all we've done is match the first field name, colon, value, and we allowed anything in the value except for a semicolon, followed by a semicolon. So when you're formatting these records, you want to choose characters that are going to separate your fields to be characters that you that are not going to be typed into the value field. Otherwise, it makes it really hard. So since we chose semicolon to separate the fields, we can't allow people to type in things that have semicolons in them, like email addresses with semicolon. Nobody has an email address with semicolon, right? So we're pretty safe. I don't think people's names normally have semicolons. But if they typed in a semicolon, then we'd be in trouble. If we were really going to be safe, we would scan the user input and make sure that whatever they typed in didn't have our field-separated character. And if it did, we'd replace it by something else, like vertical bar or something. The field names we make up, so it's okay for them to be restricted in the number of characters they have. But the values the people are typing in, this arbitrary junk, so we have to be careful about what we allow them to type in. All right, so let's look at the next part. So this is a while loop. Match, and it will succeed if it finds something. And so in the body of the while loop, we introduce a new variable called $foo. I think Tom is an old Lisp programmer who wrote this. And it's going to be an associative array in which we're going to assign the name of the field. $1 is a variable that refers to what we remembered in the first parenthesis, the name of the field. And $2 is a variable that remembers what we put in the second parenthesis, which is the value. So this assigns that to this array. Now we reassign record to be, the post match. So this is the part of the record, the part of this match that came after whatever matched. The part of the string that came after the substring that was matched. So this takes off the first keyword value pair and leaves the rest of it. So this will keep going until all the keyword value pairs are off, for all the keyword value pairs on that particular line. So after this, so this is a part of a loop which is reading lots of lines, and after we have read all the lines that come in the middle of the record, and we come to the slash record tag, this associative array foo will have in it as key value pairs all the field names and values that were in the record. So let's look at the post-processing. So when we get to the slash record tag, we're supposed to, so we look up the field's name, email, platform in this variable foo, and then we print them out to the user, and we format it in HTML so that the email address is this mail to link, as I said. So for each record that's found, the loop will the outer loop will keep going around until it finds all the records until there's no more lines in the database file. We should unlock and then we close the file. And this is what we do if there's, or this is the rest of the HTML body. It has some going back links. There's some more code here that does the search. That searches as it reads the records, it searches for a particular field. And I want you to program an example that's more like that and to work out, design some fields where you want to match some different kinds of formats. Like, for example, when you look up names to make sure that you don't restrict people to either upper or lower case. If full names are in the database, to allow people to look up first names or last names, and so on, just to have at least two fields in which you look up and do some sort of string processing to find the match. Whoops, all the way back to Hello World. So were there any questions about those two examples, the database write and the database read? So the main idea is that you have a HTML page in which you collect information, you keep appending it as a record to a file. Then there's another HTML page where you can either print out everything in the file or you can look up various fields. Okay. I'm still getting this annoying microphone hum. I guess I should just turn this down some. Is that better? Is that better? Can you still hear me okay? All right, so we're going to go back to the CGI talk. We already went over all the first part, which we, and we looked at the pizza example. Now we're going to go to just a kind of a miscellany of what I'm calling advanced topics. Maybe I shouldn't call them advanced topics, except that's what one of my CGI books calls them, but it's just other CGI topics. What we've discussed so far is sort of the basic CGI mechanism, how to have a link to a Perl script or how to pass input from a form to a Perl script and how to get the response back. And these are some of the other things you can do. So I have some slides here on password protection. Actually, that's not a CGI thing at all, but it just sort of is in the right kind of topic because it's one of the things that you want to do to web pages that isn't always so obvious what to do. So when you install a web server, you have various configuration files that control things like the paths of the document directory, but you also have something called an access control file that controls what kind of authorization people can have in order to access the entire document directory. And the kinds of things that you can do is you can set passwords. You can have groups with passwords. You can limit what kind of methods. You can deny or allow from particular hosts. So you have some controls over what kind of access you're going to allow for your web pages. So that's the general access file for the web page, for the whole web server. But in addition, any set of web documents that is in a particular directory you can set up your own what's called client-side password protection that only allows people with the password to access that the documents in that directory. And that's the kind of thing that we have set up. For example, in the Java, we have examples from books that are under copyright protection, so we only allow people that are registered in classes to access that. So what you do is in the directory that you want to protect, there you put a file that's called the .htaccess file. And I haven't given the full syntax here. I've just given an example of the kind of thing you want to do. Authorization type is basic. Authorization name is a particular group. Authorization user file is the path of the password file. And notice that I can put the password file should not be in a public document area. I put it someplace else where people can't read it from the World Wide Web. So the password file should not be in a public area. I can also put an authorization group file, and I didn't put one in, so I put /dev/null. Now in the limit part, I do allow both get and post methods, and I require what's called valid user, which requires that the person have type in a username which has an entry in the password file. Now the password file has encrypted passwords, and you create it with a program that comes with a web server called htpassword, and the htpassword program, you tell it where you want the password file to be, and you type in a series of names and passwords, which are the ones you're going to allow. And they can either be names and passwords for specific people. Notice that these won't be necessarily people's Unix names at all, and they certainly won't be people's Unix passwords. Or you can put in like one name and password, like if I wanted to assign everybody in this class access, I could put in one name, CPS616, and tell you all what the password was, and then you could all access that directory by typing in that name and password. So these are pretty easy to set up, and I just wanted to show that. Now we do come to sort of the different kinds of CGI service. And I'm not going to give complete detail about this. One of the things I want to show is really how easy some of these things are, but you often hear about these kinds of things. Server push, client pull, server side includes. So I just wanted to give a little bit about each of those topics so you knew what they were. So the first is server push. And what happens with server push is in the normal HTTP response mechanism, the server gives one reply, and then the connection is cut. But essentially, server push allows the server to give a multi-part message. So the server can give one reply. It tells the browser that this is multi-part and not to close the connection, wait for something else. So typically, what? What? Which one? Well, that's the one that enables you to hear me. This is the one that enables the recording to happen. So we'll hope it's still working. I'll just have to talk up. So anyway, typically you do this not because the web server wants to return lots of information at one time, but because it has information that's changing over time, and it wants to wait a while before it sends the next one. So what you do is you send a reply which has a special, what's called a non-parsed header. And how you indicate that is that there's a CGI script has a special form of the name. So the CGI script that you write, in this example it's .cgi, but it could be .perl, instead of just being called some Perl program name, has NPH dash on the front to tell, so that the server knows that this CGI script is going to generate a non-parsed header, a multi-part message. So it also, in the header, it has to have this special MIME type, multi-part X mixed replaced, as the content type. So I have an example here which sketches out some code that actually what it does is it sends a sequence of images with waiting in between as if it wanted to make an animation. And it was the simplest example that I could find quickly. It's not a real practical example because now that we have animated GIFs, there are better ways to run animations than to do server push. So this is typically you would use it when the server was creating or had information which changed over time and not previously defined animations. But the example shows a previously defined animation. So it assumes that we have a set of GIF files that make up an animation sequence. So there's a set of image files that are of the form .gif. There's a text file which has the names of these GIFs in the order that they're supposed to be sent. And here is a Perl program which sends them as a multi-part message, a server push. So first there's this subroutine called file size. I wanted you to see this because I'm not sure if you've got to this yet in your Perl lecture, but one of the things that Perl can do with its I mentioned it has direct access to a lot of system stuff, is it can call the system command called stat. And what it gets, for whatever the argument to the subroutine is, it returns all this information as the status of that particular file. And one of the things it returns is the size of the file. So this subroutine, if you give it a file name, will call this Unix function, which one of the things it returns is the size of the file. And so it returns dollar size as a result of this routine. So the first thing we do is open this file for reading called list file, which is going to have the names, and we read in at one time into this array called infiles the names of all the files that we want to send. Now here's where we print the main response header. We give the HTTP service. We're allowed to actually put on header parts that the web browser would supply if we didn't put it there. We can tell the web server what service we want it to reply with. And we put this special content type, multi-part mixed replace. The other thing we put on the content type is the string that's going to start the boundary information in between each part of the message that we're going to send. So the idea is the Perl program prints to the server everything, the message it wants to send, and when it wants to say that's the first message, it gives a boundary string, and the boundary string, another list programmer must have written this, starts with foo. Actually, it's going to start with dash foo. But. So that's the convention. So here's a loop which, for each file name, it gets the file size, it prints the header of the message, of the individual message that it's going to send. The content, it has to give the content link for images, and the content type is image/GIF. Then it opens that file, it uses this other command to read the entire file into a buffer, it closes the file, and it uses this syswrite command to write it, the entire file, to the web server. Then we go to sleep for a while. This is a dummy Perl command that happens to go to sleep for a little bit under a second. So we send the individual message which sends the image, and then we go to sleep, and then we go back around the loop and, I'm sorry, I left out part. And then after we send that message, we print the boundary message, dash foo, actually dash foo dash, and we go around the loop again. Whoops. There's something not right. This is the message that you put at the end. Dash food dash is an end. Oh, here's the one that's in between. I'm sorry. It's just dash foo. It's the boundary message in between. Okay, so that's an example of server push. So you tell it, the web server, you're going to send a multi-part message, and then you send one message, you wait, you send the next message, and so on. But as I said, if you wanted to have these animation sequences, nowadays people take the set of GIFs and they make an animated GIF. Here is a website where you can go and make animated GIFs. There are other ones on the web which you can easily find if you have a set of GIFs that you want to make into an animation. And they're much faster because they're all downloaded to the client, and then they can be run through many times instead of this server push thing would only run through the animation once. Now, the sort of the opposite of server push is client pull, which is that the web server can send an HTTP response with a header of type refresh. So one of the header fields is refresh. It has the number of seconds that the browser is supposed to wait before sending for another request, and it gives the URL that the browser is supposed to request. So if the browser makes a certain kind of request, the web server can respond, here's your first part, but after this number of seconds, ask me again and I'll send you another message. This is in server push, the connection is kept open while the web server sends all these messages. So it's a little more, so it uses up more resources on a long-term basis. In client pull, it's better for, especially if you're going to wait a long time in between messages, because the connection is closed and then reopened. Of course, there's the overhead of reopening the connection. So the kinds of things that are typically mentioned as being good with client pull are things like stock market updates. You can have a web page where if you contact the stock market web server, it will keep telling you, in so many seconds, ask me for a stock market update, and on your web page, you'll just automatically get stock market updates. And presumably they can program the thing so that the stocks you're interested in, if they're moving slowly, you don't get updated very often, and if they're moving fast, you get updated quite often and that kind of thing. I have some section here about maintaining state with hidden fields, how to design those. We saw those in the example we did with the database, so I'm going to skip those for now. I'm kind of short on time. But I do want to mention Netscape cookies. So Netscape cookies are another way to save state. Unfortunately, it only works with Netscape browsers at the current time. And what it does is store information on the client side. So basically, the browser can, the server can send a header that has a special set cookie field in the header, and then the browser will set up on the client machine a place to save information that has that label. There are some conditions that the server also sends, and then every time the browser makes a request that satisfies those conditions, it will send the information associated with the user. So essentially, the server can request to save information that it can get at with the user. Things like the username and email address and standard stuff could all be saved in a form that the server could get at, and the user wouldn't have to keep retyping it in every time they made a request. But it does only work if the user is using the same browser program. I mean, you can't go, if the user is using different machines, then they won't get their, the information is only stored in a browser. Here's the URL of the current cookie specification. Let me just briefly show you some examples of the kind of syntax. So the server sends back a header that looks something like this. It has the usual content type line, but then it has a line that just has a, in the header, that has a set cookie field. And what the cookie is a keyword value pair. It's just like the kind of field and things we've been looking at. But you can also put these conditions. You can make it expire at a certain time, so this cookie will only be valid up until that time. And you can give particular domain or path that the cookie is valid for. So when the browser sends a request to that domain with that particular directory, then it will send the cookie, and otherwise it won't send the cookie along with its request. So presumably the server that sets up the cookie sets it up so that only requests on its particular domain will get the cookie information set back to it. If you're writing a Perl script and you gave a header which set up did a set cookie, and then somebody sends a request to a Perl script for which the browser thinks it's appropriate to send the cookie information, there is an environment variable called http_cookie. So all your script has to do is look up in the environment variable and find out the value of the cookie, or find out all the values of all the cookies that were sent. The last topic is server-side includes. We're pretty much out of time, so let me just tell you briefly what this is. This is not strictly a CGI thing. This is a web server capability which has some similarities with CGI, in that what happens is that if you send back HTML files that have this particular tag, not HTML, but .shtml, the web server can be instructed to examine all these files before it sends them back, and to find particular commands and replace parts of the file. So a .shtml file has regular HTML file, plus it has special server-side include tags. And the kind of tags it can have are, there's a set of tags called echo variable in which you give environment variables. So you can have the values of environment variables inserted into the HTML documents on the fly as they're returned to the browser. And here's a set of environment variables in addition to all the other environment variables that we normally have. Or you can tell it to include a particular file, so you can automatically include address files or header files or something into the HTML. Or you can tell it to execute a CGI script as the HTML is being sent back to the browser. So this really has the effect of, it's a normal CGI mechanism, similar to the normal CGI mechanism. So that's what people mean by server-side includes. This is one way that people often set up those counters, because every time the HTML page is retrieved, the server-side include can insert the new counter number and execute a script that updates the old counter number. So that's one way that people often do that. Now, the web server that we've installed for you to play with on Osprey 7 isn't set up for server-side includes, so you can't play with this part. But you can play with all the other parts. And one of the reasons I wanted to just show you all this stuff briefly is I actually think that it's all pretty simple. I mean, it's just more kinds of header information that you send back with your CGI script that causes these things to happen. Okay, so for your homework, I'm not sure what the deadline is, and I need to talk to Professor Fox. So I left no deadline. I don't know if it'll be, presumably somewhere between 1 week and 2 weeks. I described the thing, and I'm sorry, I didn't include all the information I need to tell you. When you append to a file, you have to be careful how you set it up, you set up on that file. And I didn't get that written in. I'll get that added tomorrow morning as soon as I can. I came here and I forgot my office key, so I couldn't get in and finish your homework. One of those days. Thank you very much.